a psychoanalyst, so I see people who have problems using masturbation, perhaps, not just as a simple pleasure, but as an emotional or a sexual cul-de-sac. Okay? I worked for 25 years at the Portman Clinic, which works with people who use sexuality or violence or aggression to express their internal worlds, usually on the bodies and minds of other people. Okay? Psychotic people often smash their own minds up. Perverse and violent patients use other people's bodies and hurt them. The penetration of the market into all forms of life, the transformations of activities into commodities, become so total that we now cease to see it. Ideology can coincide with what we take to be just the way the world is. We have ideology in its purest and most deadly form. It's like the Hunger Games, where we have a category of human beings, A-list celebrities, that create a delusion that some people actually live and look like this. These A-listers are attractive but relatively unintelligent human beings that are paraded around in front of other human beings. They don't produce or do very much and can get paid huge amounts for wandering around and looking beautiful. And the rest are just, of us are reduced quite often to voyeurs, watching this porn of celebrity Big Brother or the sad Kardashians, who fill the void in increasingly pointless existence aimed at staying on top, avoiding the terror of failure. In this way, I think we're all reduced to wankers to some extent, watching this. Porn in particular, I've now moved into a more edifying part of the human existence, working with people who have real loss and real pain. But the number of people I'm seeing now, young people addicted to porn, is enormous. Okay? Addicted to porn and its symptom, masturbation. Okay? Nothing wrong with masturbation, it's a rehearsal, but hopefully it's a dress rehearsal for the real thing, not a place you want to spend the rest of your life. You know? The trouble is with porn, it actually affects, as they found out now in a lot of research, they have actually affects the brain to some extent. The quick fix becomes the aim rather than the difficulty of actually having to relate to another human being, which, as we all know, is extremely difficult. Okay? So masturbation is gradually taking over to some extent, making us all into a nation of voyeurs, and pornography is at the core of it. I'm just going to quote Chris Hedges, who wrote a wonderful masterpiece called The Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle. We've all been reduced to a voyeuristic position. Porn films are not about sex. Sex is airbrushed and digitally washed out of the films. There is no acting because none of the women are permitted to have what amounts to a personality. The only emotion they are allowed to display is an unquenchable desire to satisfy men, especially if that desire involves the woman's physical and emotional degradation. The lighting in the film is harsh and clinical. Porn, which advertises itself as sex, is a bizarre, bleached pantomime of sex. The acts on screen are beyond human endurance, in my view anyway. The scenarios are absurd. Those in the films are puppets, packaged female commodities. They have no honest emotions, are devoid of authentic human beauty, and resemble plastic. In fact, now we have plastic dolls and robots to actually take their place. Pornography does not promote sex. If one defines sex as a shared act between two partners, it promotes masturbation. It promotes auto-arousal that precludes intimacy and love. Pornography is about getting yourself off at someone else's expense. Okay? So this is where masturbation goes a bit wrong. It becomes a cul-de-sac rather than the royal motorway, as it were, to human intimacy. Okay. I won't go on about the prefrontal cortex. I will digress slightly here to demonstrate the use of masturbation and pornography to manage violence, which cannot be symbolized. In my practice, I saw two priests who lost their father through violence, one through a car accident, the other through an IRA revenge killing, roughly around the same age, 4 or 5. They dealt with the violent termination of their fathers in different ways. The first, something I saw, had a psychotic breakdown in front of his congregation, just like this, where he took down the cross from the pulpit, wherever it is, and asked to be united with his father in heaven whilst lying on a cross. Sort of reenactment of a well-known story. He was admitted to Murray Jackson's unit for psychotic patients and made a full recovery, acknowledging the loss of his father and discovering that instead of being a priest, he wanted to have girlfriends. The second priest, however, more seriously, was discovered masturbating while watching internet porn of underage children being abused. As you can see, One breaks down, the psychotic patient has a decency to break down over the pain of this loss and uses the Christian myth as concrete enactment, rather like Christ, arguably, to be reunited with his lost father. The other via masturbation and porn enacts the painful abandonment of a child by sexualizing it. Watching children in duress who have no father to help them. The degradation of these children seemed to be important to this man, perhaps representing his own degraded, abject self that no one could rescue him from experiencing. A patient recently came because she was depressed. She eventually confided in me that she participated in masturbatory relationships and pornography with her partner. When I tried to suggest there may be a connection with her unhappiness and this restricted behavior she indulged in, she was put out. Surely, she said, we have moved on from this straight, gay, cisgender, male attitude towards pornography, equating sexual orientation with intimacy and love. No, for God's sake, you know, pull yourself together. She was representing the idea, I think, of the modern erotic. The modern erotic being, if it's sexy, it's fine, okay? However, psychoanalysts have this special knowledge we like to think we have. You may be completely deluded, of course, but we have this special knowledge that actually all activity has an unconscious basis to it, okay? So it's not that masturbation is good or bad. It's what the intention is in the masturbatory sort of fantasy, okay? Mr. D came into analysis because he was a great kisser. He said he felt like Rodin's statue of the kiss. He was permanently frozen in time as the statue kissed. He was such a great kisser, he said, and gained complete erotic and sexual satisfaction in this way. Indeed, he had many girlfriends, but they left disappointed when they discovered this is all he could do or wanted to do. He was good at creating desire like Don Giovanni. He was good at creating desire in his objects, but unlike Don Giovanni, was unable to consummate relationships because he seemed he got caught stuck in this oral relationship, unable to progress further. It's important to note the effect he had on his partners. He excited them, apparently with mature kisses, but left them aroused and frustrated when they wanted more. Perhaps his partners could be seen as having too much attachment to a paradigmatic view of sexuality. He was just, you know, being himself and cool, and the erotic, and should have been more amenable to his limited view of sexual interest. But as he found to his pain, this was hard to find, even on the internet. This preoccupation with one aspect of sexual contact could be porn, the smell of rubber, stealing from shops, as a man I saw years ago who was turned on and masturbated over the idea of stealing alarms from alarm shops. Okay, that wasn't hard, as an analyst thing. He must be rather alarmed somewhere. But in my view, the apparent limited involvement with these things always involves a much more complicated unconscious fantasy and scenario, rather than that created by the vehicle of sexual pleasure with another person. Many erotic practices, including masturbation, innocent masturbation, I mean masturbation that's used as a cul-de-sac or a psychic retreat, have distant management of the other at the heart. The voyeur reverses his frightened, paranoid anxiety by becoming the secret watcher, so as other people who are vulnerable to his look, such as Mr. D, who was terrified of his own sexual anxieties and impotence with women, and who conquered them by installing tiny cameras in women's showers, which he used to watch and masturbate to. Or Mr. C, with his terrors of a promiscuous mother with her many violent lovers, who reversed the frightening primal scene by watching his wife having sexual contact with other men while he masturbated, so he could reverse his feelings of humiliation as a child by controlling this unreliable, frightening couple. Or Dr. D, whose early life was so replete with morbidity and death, that she sexualized death, masturbating on the internet over images of morbidity, finding the ending of relationships and their demise more exciting than the possibility of life-enhancing love. Or the exhibitionist in Crouch End who would flash to a double-decker bus, okay, which is quite a, you know, get 24 people at once. It's very powerful. Reversing his own anxieties and isolation by eroticizing flashing at innocent bystanders who were then shocked by his sexual behavior, usually conducted whilst they were in lonely places, sexualization of loneliness. If you think about Don Giovanni and Valmont from Liaison Dangerous, they seem only interested in the eroticization of conquest, and these conquests could be seen as the ultimate status symbol of the freedom-seeking libertine, except for the effect they have on their victims or accomplices. Why does the Don only want to conquer and leave? Why is Valmont so excited by the conquest and seduction of a virgin? This sort of erotic interest seems only driven by something else other than sexual pleasure. something that promotes anxiety and fear in the other. I recently gave a talk, actually it was about 10 years ago, on the subject of objectum sex. Something happened to me on the way to the theatre. On the subject of objectum sex, about women who had a masturbatory relationship with the Eiffel Tower. Okay? It was so sexy and erotic that she had a marriage. She married it. Or another one who was married to the Berlin Wall. And you can see she had a terrible loss. It didn't quite work. Sexualizing an inanimate object, it disappeared. But actually, she's got a model now of the Berlin Wall, which she's now relating to. Okay. In these two cases, the women involved felt that there was something really erotic going on. But I saw something which I would call psychotic and tragic. So whilst I agree that sexuality and the erotic and masturbation should be divorced from conventional moral judgment, as did Freud, I would say that in some erotic forms of sexuality and masturbation, there is some aggression and hatred. And it's often an enactment whereby sexuality is used to carry far more complex feelings and emotions rather than just sexual pleasure. I'll just give you a rather prolonged case study, which Anna and us always do at this point. Mr. D came into treatment feeling confused and depressed because his wife refused to participate in his masturbatory activity, which would involve him dressing up in women's clothing and masturbating in front of her, and was threatening to leave. She joined a feminist group, basically, and the feminists were going, what are you putting up with this for? You know. He wanted to be a writer, but he only wrote articles for a women's magazine that were rejected. He lived on a trust fund left to him by his mother, rather enviously, which was also paid for his house and everything. Mr. D's father had left the family when he was 3, leaving mother depressed and unavailable. He felt very lonely in his early childhood and remembered having a rubber sheet that comforted him. This attachment to materials and rubbing himself up against them intensified later into a secret wish to dress up in his mother's clothes. He described a sense of calm that would descend on him at these times. And he found the experience of putting on and taking off his mother's clothes and masturbating extremely gratifying, relieving him from confusion. So he sexualized an unreliable object. If you have a very depressed mother, it's very frightening. She's supposed to provide you with the equipment to manage life and death anxieties. She didn't. So he used his body and sexuality in a rather profound way, which suited a 5-year-old, but to a 35-year-old, it wasn't so great. It was a defense system that outlived its sell-by date. Okay. And it fell apart because his wife was saying no. After university, he married his wife, a student from abroad, who became very dependent on him. She had been sexually abused by her father. And together they regressed to an isolated world. He drew her into his activities, dressing up and masturbating in front of her. He felt this gave him power over her that comforted him through projecting his needy infantile self into her, whilst he became the prider with his trust fund and his masturbation and all that sort of stuff. His wife's subsequent refusal to participate in this arrangement distressed him. His fragile world was collapsing. He described feeling almost catatonic with depression, raising himself from his torpor only to eat or evacuate. In frustration, he berated his wife, often violently, for being stupid and lazy, projective identification. He kept her financially and threatened her with eviction. Since they married, their sexual relationship was minimal except for masturbatory activity. She seemed at first willing to play the voyeur to his exhibitionism, presumably reenacting her own abuse by her father. Okay? Projective gridlock, as Mary Morgan, not my relatives, calls it. Mr. D told me the story with little sense of shame, but with rage that his wife could wish to depart from this arrangement. In my countertransference, I'm embarrassed to say, my own morality coming in, I'm sure, I felt the pricklings of rather some disgust towards this baby man, who rather enviously neither had to work for money, as I had to work hard, and whose sexual practices were both infantile to me, at face value, a bit silly. One man's perversion can look rather silly to another human being. Okay? As he described his violence towards his wife and others, I had to manage my own aggressive feelings towards him, and to struggle to find some productive way of thinking about it, not masturbate over my own ideas and theories, but try to understand what the hell he was doing. I was particularly struck by the visceral strength of my emotional reaction to Mr. D's presentation. I was shocked to find the depth of my feelings, aggression or annoyance to Mr. D for his false guru self, who bullied his wife, whilst he was at the same time stuck inside his mummy in a house that had been bought for him with a trust fund provided for him, trying to get further inside his mummy with his women's magazines writing. It felt as if I were being cruel to someone who was desperate and abject. It took me some time to realise how difficult it was to feel the plight of this infant who was so deprived he had to turn to masturbation to keep himself going. I always remember the Mexican earthquake years ago when they pulled the children out of the earthquake. A lot of the children were looking at their own hands. Okay, they'd somehow survived by keeping themselves company. Okay, with an object. Better to invest part of yourself with something than nothing. Okay, better a hand than an empty void. Okay, and I think for lots of patients I've seen who use masturbation in this way as a developmental cul-de-sac, that is what happens. Throughout my work with Mr. D, I would at times shockingly feel I was in the room with somebody who felt like a large poo on the couch. Terrible thing to say, I know. And while I disliked myself for this fleeting idea, it came to help me get hold of what I believe Mr. D's mother must have felt towards her two dependent boys. He had a brother, with their nappies and infantile needs. Well, she was abandoned and depressed. There was in reality at that time, Mr. D's early life, little sense of any couple or procreative coupling. It took time on our walk for any sense of coupling to emerge. He was very much an isolated person. My early understanding was Mr. D projected his infantile self into his wife, and she had to stay in this position while he masturbated, keeping all the dependency of fear away from him, whilst he retained the power to look after her or abandon her as his father had abandoned him. His own experiences reversed and projected into his wife, who was always frightened that he would leave. He reversed earlier experiences of deprivation through putting them physically and psychologically into the body and mind of the other. I think about Harvey Weinstein and the way he treats women as well. His wife is a masturbatory object. They're just pornography that should be there for his use. The fact they have minds of their own is appalling. His wife's experience of abuse made her an available recipient of his projections. In the first year of his analysis, he was increasingly fearful about his needy self-surfacing. He became enormously anxious about becoming addicted to therapy, which he said was an arrangement that would rob him of his autonomy. I was a bit of a wanker. I just used patients for my own ends, which at some point, of course, financially, I do. He felt that I was intent on seducing him into a relationship with me so I could use him entirely for my own ends without considering him. He was convinced of the accuracy of his perceptions and oblivious to the irony that it contained a mirror image of how he used his wife. I interpreted his anxiety, saying he feared that I was a rather empty analyst whose own life was so devoid of any real substance that I derived my only comfort by seducing and controlling my patients into providing me with the feelings of power, lacking my own impoverished life. He was interested in these observations and curious at my willingness, it might be true, but obviously I don't think it's true, but you make your own mind up, to be explored as such an unattractive figure. And this is the beginning of his willingness to think about rather than act his early experiences. But as he became more aware of his dependence upon me, now perhaps more of a father or another object in the transference, instead of getting better, his fury with his wife increased. And this is what often happens as people move away from what I might call a perversion, which is using sexuality for aggressive reasons. Then instead of actually it improving, it often accelerates and becomes worse. After a bank holiday weekend, he felt enraged with her, calling her a bloodsucker, as if she was a parasite that he felt like killing to protect himself. However, he comforted himself through falling back on his own regressed behavior, compulsively dressing up and masturbating. Thus, he seems to evacuate any awareness of his own emerging dependency on me into his wife, whilst he in fantasy becomes self-sufficient. As with many patients with these sorts of problems, the real threat of violence and distastefulness of the defences produced in me the feeling that he was the blood-sucking parasite that I would like to get rid of in a violent manner. However, I didn't, and I encouraged him to think rather than act his feelings of frustration and rage. He became very critical of me. "You're a man dressed up in the clothing of psychoanalysis, a discredited theory used as a way to control people." I thought he was searching for a mind which could contain and understand his evacuated feelings of abandonment and loss, rather than become identified with them like his mother and wife, or reject him by walking out like his father. He was looking for somebody who wasn't just a wanker, I think. I knew both through theory and experience that Mr. D had to feel towards me the contempt he felt towards others and feared from me. If I could bear it, he might be able to have some sense of what a relationship with a paternal figure could be, in order to be able to begin to renounce his infantile feelings and masturbatory relationship with his partner, and to accept there might be a possibility that there were couples who could come together and create something without one person using the other person as an object to project into. After the third year, there was an important development. His need to project the unwanted aspects of himself into his wife, who was becoming stronger to her feminist group, and he became terrified he was going to slip into a master depression. He dreamt of falling, losing his grip, being lost at sea with a lighthouse in the distance, of losing himself in the underground. These dreams suggest original fears of disintegration of the overwhelming mother and the distant, perhaps unavailable help father who might have been able to throw light on his predicament and save him. His fears of being engulfed by a void felt palpable, and we are confronted by the possibility that he might break down. I began to think, well, masturbation's not so bad, actually. You know, it keeps you going, you know. And somehow I'd removed this rather important defense system. I was mindful of the attacks he might make on his wife as a perversion or an enactment dissipates, the evacuation into others grows, the dangers of it, and that he might break down. I was also mindful he might actually attack his wife, so she would become the recipient of his breaking down self. This manifested actually, shockingly, or in a way helpfully, as a powerful wish to impregnate her, despite her wishes, thinking this would provide relief from his own feelings. I was able to say to him, because this was tangible to me, that he wished to get rid of his childlike feelings in his analysis by putting them physically into his wife, impregnating her with his split-off self, enacting, perhaps, this is arguable, a bit politics, the transvestite's wish to occupy the mother. Whoops, careful. This interpretation made sense to him, and for the first time I began to feel that there were two minds in the room, and that we were beginning to do creative work together. At this dry time, he had a dream confirming his emergent baby-like feelings and his fear of them. He was living in a flat on the set of El Dorado, which is a soap opera, some of you will remember, a soap opera that flopped. He was with his wife. He thought it was wonderful, but a child looked into the window of the flat, and he felt terrified it would get in and take over. The flat was taken over by lots of children, and him and his wife are overwhelmed. I said, I think his dependency on me frightened him, because he feared that we might not be able to cope, and I was a bit concerned I might not be able to cope. I noted, though, that he and his wife shared some feelings, and although terrified, they were a couple. A week later, he reported a second dream. He was again in the flat in El Dorado with his wife, but this time he was aware of being very, very frightened indeed. The whole set is on fire, and he realized it was just a superficial film set and was about to collapse. But as it was collapsing, the Prince of Wales rescued him and then left him, David Morgan. Okay. And as he said, you're going bald in the same place as he is. I thought that though Mr. D was beginning to feel rescued by me, I quickly abandoned him like father. And around about this time, roughly, he rediscovered where his father lived, and amidst great pain and sadness, found he was remarried secretly with two children. Really, really painful. In this intervention from reality came at a point in Mr. D's analysis when he was able to think and ultimately mourn rather than simply project and deny, using masturbatory sort of sexuality as a way of projecting need into his wife whilst he held on to all the stuff. By this time, my own feelings of needing to reject and feel contempt for him had correspondingly abated. I was less of a masturbatory analyst myself, I think. It seemed to me crucial that with Mr. D, some recognition of a procreative internal couple could be restored in order that he could grow up. Painful though it was, the refinding of Mr. D's father and Mr. D's acknowledgement of help from his stepfather, who was around in the story, led to more mature defences and a relationship with his wife that relied less on infantile projections and compulsive masturbation. For this patient, and many patients like this, the facts of life are intolerable. They've never experienced a mind that can think about things with them. So they're left in a world where all they can do is enact their problems on the bodies and minds of other people using masturbation to do that. And the Harvey Weinsteins and this recent case recently, and people like that, you can see are treating women with utter contempt and using women, I think, to project aggression and violence into and control and sadomasochism. Because at some level, there's something deeply impoverished and depressed, I think, being played out using women as a container for parts of themselves, using women, to some extent, as a masturbatory object. So I think the penetration of the market into all forms of life does affect us all in this way. I think we're all in danger of being commodified and turned into people that are excited by things rather than human beings. Okay, We all wake up in the morning, and lots of us go on our laptop before we say hello to our wife, it's sort of or partner, sorry. These things are very, very powerful. There's a seduction, what I call to distraction. Okay, some people use distraction more than others, and quite a lot. When I see people come to the consulting for the first time who live in these masturbatory worlds where distractions and pornography and particular attitude towards women dominates, the idea of a space between two people where you wait to see what happens is utterly terrifying. Okay? It's the beginning. I often say to the people at the Portman Clinic, it was really important to know that they'd never experienced the mind thinking about them before, ever. So what they were, only way they could actually relate to people is physically. Because they actually had no capacity for conceptualization and thinking. So the physical body is used quite often sexually, not for sex, not for pleasure, not for joy. This is where Freud was right. Yep, 1 minute left. Good. It's a quick one. Okay. But for the body is used as a way of communicating in a sort of slightly concrete, metaphorical sort of way. And masturbation, I think, and being locked in a cul-de-sac. But masturbation dominates your life is a way of, I think, actually reducing human relationships to an onanistic self-pleasure where the other person is reduced to an object, okay? Often replaying their own experiences, okay? They've been treated by objects. They perhaps had very depressed early experiences. So they don't have the equipment to manage life and death. So one of the brilliant defenses of the child is to stimulate yourself, like the Mexican children in the earthquake. Creating a hand to keep yourself company. Keeping yourself company through masturbation is fine. It's how a lot of us got through our adolescence, but to stay there forever, I think, is usually the result of a need for a retreat from human relationships, all their terror. Human relationships are frightening, because they actually expose you to yourself. And if you've never had relationships that can help you engage at a deep level with yourself, then it's very frightening indeed. So masturbation, in this particular paper, isn't just a pleasure, it's a cul-de-sac, I think, used as a psychic retreat to avoid the complexity and the joys and the pains of human relationships with all their limitations and wonderfulness. Thank you. Okay.